Welcome, fellow seekers. My name is Nathan, and this is the Law of One and Spiritual Concepts podcast, where I share my interpretations of the Law of One and other related topics. Today, it is my pleasure to welcome Chris back to the show for a fascinating discussion on the Veil of Forgetting and how it creates an illusion of separation on our path back to unity. I hope you all enjoy. Let's get into it. Welcome back, Chris. How are you?
Thanks, Nathan. Great to be here. Doing really well. Thank you.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm excited about this conversation here on the Veil of Forgetting as a separation pathway back to unity. So I think it'll be a great conversation.
I think so as well.
So I guess to start, kind of wanted to consider the topic of the veil and how this creates the appearance of separation from there. So I guess from a high level, we see the veil as an experiment by our logos that created a semi-permeable veil between our conscious and unconscious mind in the third density entity. So incarnate entity, that is, too. So it's only third density that experiences this veil. And then this creates then the illusion of separation through this unconscious mind, conscious mind splitting, basically, in this incarnation. So I think you had some information on some of the history as well of the veil that maybe you could share.
Sure, I'm happy to. And I, you know, there's a lot to unpack in there for people that aren't familiar with the Law of One. Hopefully most of your listeners are. You know, it's the idea that the separation was kind of an innovation in the evolution of life in our galaxy. You know, as Ross says, you know, the life began, or what we would consider life, towards the center of our universe and kind of, of our galaxy, and then started spreading outward. And we are on like one of the arms of the spiral, pretty far out from the central hub. And what Ra explains is that this was an innovation that came about towards the center of our galaxy and was ultimately so successful that it spread kind of all the way out. And as you mentioned, it's really like a division between our conscious and our unconscious minds that we take on when we enter a physical body. So the concept of a veil isn't new. Like anything that is real, there are folks that have understood this going back a long time. I think Plato mentions the river of forgetting, the veil of forgetting. It's kind of figures prominently into his allegory of the cave.
Yeah.
That we lose a sense of who we really are, that we mistake the shadow of, you know, reality for the what really exists. So I think that's important. You know, when I first heard of the veil, it was years before I had found the raw material, and I was listening to a podcast about, it was like a medium that had been channeling, you know, non-corporeal beings, and they were getting information, and they asked, like, well, how is it that you're able to know this? And the answer was like, we are beyond the veil. I'm like, well, that's interesting. What does that mean? And it's a concept that, you know, you see in mediumship, the idea that if we're outside our body, we're no longer limited by this narrow, dim view. We can see the bigger picture. We talked about it in the NDE context. When people leave the body, they all of a sudden have this incredibly expanded awareness. I was surprised to find out it's also part of like in the Church of Latter-day Saints of Jesus Christ, the Mormon tradition. They also have this concept of what they call the veil of forgetfulness, which is just another way of talking about this, how we are cut off from knowledge of our true self while we're here.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too. And when they talk about Ra's ways of speaking to us through this channeling mechanism, was also coming up with concepts that were familiar to us and maybe putting it in a different light. So that's not necessarily, like you said, new to Ra's teachings, but they're using kind of the baseline of what was provided before for us maybe to understand better and to better explain it in this sense.
Well said. And, you know, there's two things that Ra explains that I don't think any of the prior sources talking about the veil really did. And one is that it really represents, you know, so there was always the idea that we are that we forget our true selves, we're cut off from that. But until Ra, I don't think anyone explained that it's really this division between our conscious and unconscious minds.
Yeah.
That our minds are now complex. They are made up of a couple different independent things. So the idea that this forgetting comes from this division between our conscious and unconscious minds, and then also that it's the separateness, the separation of the veil that ultimately gives rise to the service to self-polarity, what we would call evil in a colloquial sense. So I think Ra was the first one to really tie this together for me, that these are all explained by this, you know, one innovation that happened, you know, earlier in our galaxy.
It's fascinating to kind of put that concept together there of creating the service to self path that it wasn't even thought of before. It wasn't even an option, or they couldn't even think of it until this veil came to place. And you were really given then, I guess, a greater amount of free will to choose whatever you wish to do, to be of service to others or to serve yourself, and to explore those options more and more as the creator. So it's kind of a fascinating division that really opened the doors to a much greater experience in third density.
I think you're right. And I, you know, thinking of it as a greater extension of our free will is interesting, because Ra was the first being to call it, you know, free will is really the law of confusion. It's our right to misunderstand, almost, you know, to find our own path to knowledge. And, you know, for the first time with this complete dropping of the veil, it created the opportunity for us to exercise free will to explore beyond the margins of oneness, beyond the margins of unity, to explore aspects of the creator, you know, as what they call the path of that which is not, the path that is separation, which never really existed before this full dropping of the veil.
Well, and there's more consequences to that, so we'll get into that a little bit more there too. But I thought it'd be interesting to kind of get into some of the pre-veiled conditions before, just to maybe start to explain how different life was at that point, and to kind of start to explain those far-reaching consequences that Ra talks about. So a few of the ideas that Ra brings up particularly was the concept of disease, that this was nothing that, at the time, it wasn't a catalyst to try to alert you to different blockages or issues in the body. It was just used to end the incarnation, Ra says, to basically reincarnate again at that point, which is, I don't know, kind of interesting in itself. And one of the other key points, too, is the unconscious mind being able to be accessed at that point. So all your autonomic functions, all the deep brain, deep mind sort of connection that you had to the inner planes, this whole connection was available to you.
Yeah, so it's interesting to think about, like, before the veiling, beings could basically turn off pain, they can control their heart rate, they can control their blood pressure. We had, like, total command over all those functions of the body that now we don't really have full control over anymore. And, you know, the one thing that also really changed was the importance of dreams. So Ra talks about before the veiling, because there wasn't a division between the conscious and unconscious minds, we always had access to our full beingness. The unconscious mind didn't have the same inspirational function that it does now. Like now, as he talks about, you know, in the archetypes of the mind, we have the matrix of the mind, which is like our conscious awareness that has to kind of dip into the well of inspiration of the unconscious mind that is kind of the potentiator that's driving things behind the scenes a little bit. It's like the conscious mind is now the tip of the iceberg above water. The subconscious mind is this huge thing below water. And, you know, as Ross says, like, the roots of our mind are really cosmic, you know, that the mind contains all things. And it's almost, you know, we are essentially like holographic, you know, drops, for want of a better word, of all of the universe, that we contain everything, but we're kind of cut off from all that. But ultimately, like, our mind, and especially the unconscious, is essentially like an open-ended funnel channeling, you know, all of the cosmic influences into our beingness in a way that we're not aware of anymore.
Yeah, almost like step down levels, I guess I'd say, of the unconscious mind that we're kind of journeying our way back up to that top point of the creator there. So it is fascinating. And Rod talks a lot about the roots of the tree of mind there. And that's that same analogy of us kind of penetrating that veil into the unconscious mind as you get into the roots, back down all the way through the spirit complex into the creator at the end. So it's part of that full journey. So it just, I don't know, it's fascinating that they used to have full access to that, prior to this veil. And now this is kind of opening the door, I guess, to our ability to learn.
Yeah, well said. And, you know, I think it's interesting because Ra describes third density as being like, you know, it's not the density of knowing. We can't really prove anything. Like, it's almost like a closed system when it comes to our physical sciences. There are things that can hint about the underpinnings of it, whether it's consciousness studies or quantum physics. But I think this idea that the path out of, you know, the box of our physical everyday reality is consciousness, and it's work through the disciplines of the personality, through the mind. And as Ra says, as we slowly kind of unblock our lower energy centers, once we get up to the indigo center, you know, once we make contact through work and consciousness with intelligent infinity, the being who has done that can walk the universe with unfettered tread. That at that point, you know, the non-locality of the physical world is fully internalized. We can move throughout the universe at will through powers of essentially the mind, which I think is a really cool idea.
Yeah, it's fascinating. That's when I kind of get into some of those points there of not all extraterrestrial entities are traveling in ships when you can move with consciousness and stuff to that point. So, yeah, a little out there. But I guess then, too, there was one quote I think I wanted to look at from 8519 talking a little bit about the veil. So I'll read that one here. The primary veiling was of such significance that it may be seen to be analogous to the mantling of the earth over all the jewels within the earth's crust, whereas previously all facets of the Creator were consciously known. After the veiling, almost no facets of the Creator were known to the mind. Almost all was buried beneath the veil. So that one is a pretty intense summary there, I guess, of trying to explain those far-reaching consequences and the importance of the veil from that point.
It is, and I love Ra's kind of metaphor, because just like gems buried within the ground, all those gifts and resources contained in our unconscious minds have to now be discovered, worked, and kind of refined through our own effort and will, just like mining for gems a little bit. We have to expend will to kind of figure out what they are, and then refine them over time.
Exactly. So I think that's like a good summary there of that division, or when that started, when the logo started to implement it. And I guess it's the resounding success that came from this veiling that Ra talks about that gives our third density entities here that motivation to actually learn the lessons of love, to graduate to fourth density, whether that's service to others or service to self. It really created that impetus there. And then kind of like what we were alluding to earlier, there also really gave the Creator a more vivid and intense experience to know itself through these different interactions and go down pathways maybe that weren't discovered before, open doorways there, that now we can see what the service to self pathway looks like. And it's all of this is just part of this great experience of the Creator wanting to know itself.
Well said. And I think that's the really important concept of the idea of unity. The law of one is that we are all part of one divine vibrational being that is learning about itself through an exploration of manyness, all through dividing into individuated quanta of consciousness, all interacting with free will, which provides like a contrast that just the unified, you know, consciousness of the divine being didn't have before that. So yeah. I think that's a really cool idea. So not only does it give us motivation really through suffering to learn the lessons of love, to graduate through that suffering and the interaction of polarized beings, you know, good and evil, for want of a colloquial term, it gives the Creator a much more kind of vivid and rich experience of itself that it didn't have before. So we suffer for a reason. We're adding to the fullness, the very purpose of beingness through our sacrifice a little bit.
Yeah, and kind of posing a new way to learn some of those lessons as well, too. When you only know love and unity on there, you don't understand it maybe as deep as you would without having that suffering or negativity implemented into it. So you can truly understand at that point maybe then what it means to love and to accept and to really, I guess, use that catalyst maybe to the fullest extent.
Well said. And so as Ra explains this, you know, with the innovation of a complete veil, it was such a success in terms of adding to, you know, our motivation and the a more full experience of the Creator by itself, that it was ultimately adopted throughout our galaxy for all third density beings, which the individual sublogoi or stars, whatever you want to call them, can almost communicate, as Ross says, like cells in a body. It's part of one larger structure, yeah, I guess you could say, that's not bound by time and space.
Right. So they can kind of share some of the lessons that they've learned in different kind of in other logoi and sublogoi, that they can kind of all communicate together and use whatever is the greatest pathway forward for spiritual growth and for this vivid experience.
And it's like, as Ross says, each of these logoi, these kind of subsets of consciousness, they are trying to come up with an approximation of the best way to give it the Creator an experience of itself. So yeah, they have like free will and trying to figure out, how can I do this? What does this look like? And this was some like a really helpful innovation that they're like, oh wow, this really added to the fullness of the Creator experiencing itself and helped move us along, the third density beings, on our path. So
yeah,
it kind of spread throughout the galaxy.
Right. It's like a bunch of experiments going on all simultaneously, but then like communication between what works and what doesn't. So yeah, I think we'll continue on with looking at separation, how that drives, I guess we'll say, the spiritual engine of third density here. So I think it's, as we were kind of talking about before here, the separation created that impetus for growth. It was that striving to polarize towards service to others or service to self, whether now knowingly or unknowingly by entities. There's that kind of drive in the back of, it seems like, all of our minds to get back to the Creator and to create, I guess, that spiritual polarity from there. So I guess the other key point here too is that this gave rise to the choice, which is basically making that service to others or service to self decision, whether that's 51% service to others or 95% service to self, to graduate to fourth density. And I think one of the fascinating points that you've brought up is this idea of this dynamic tension as well. So maybe you could elucidate that a little bit.
Yeah. So it's really, you know, Kuo talks about this, that this development of a more complete system of spiritual polarity is really part of a number of different systems of kind of polarized opposites, all acting in dynamic tension within third density, that give rise to the potential for work, which is essentially movement or progress. So we have, you know, electrical polarity, positive and negative polarity, in like 2D, speaking in terms of like Euclidean geometry, two-dimensional geometry, we have electrical current. Then in three dimensions, in Euclidean space, we have the idea of magnetism, fields of magnetic polarity that have led to everything from motors to super colliders. And then this veiling and this capacity, you know, the difference created between service to self and service to others polarity created a system of spiritual polarity and consciousness, which is really the idea of like the yin and yang in dynamic tension, which act as a sort of engine or kind of dynamo driving our spiritual progress forward.
Yeah, and kind of sets the baseline, I guess, for that, like you're saying there too. It's just a macrocosm to microcosm sort of correlation there of what we see polarity used in different systems, but now it's in consciousness. And it's interesting to look at too from the third density standpoint, that we keep coming back in these lifetimes here. You go through multiple incarnations and really driving to then go one direction or the other, towards service to others or service to self. So we keep going through this over and over and over until we basically choose the path of service to others or service to self. But we have these little, I'd say, almost like nudges or pushes in the background getting you going to one direction. And maybe some of that's based on your morality as well too, that you feel more naturally drawn to one way, one direction or the other, and basically to the point where it becomes natural for you. You don't have to think about some of these things, that you are serving others on a daily basis just because that's your being. And I think that's really when you truly graduate or open the heart on the positive path.
That's a great point. And another way that Rod describes these polarities, you know, he talked about service to self, service to others in terms of ethics, but they also say that it's really functionally a greater ability to handle and work with the love light of the Creator. And another way to describe it is some become more radiant and some become more absorbent. And it's almost like with the love and light of the Creator that we're all kind of channeling or bringing into third density, some folks act as like a spout or a spigot, and some folks act as a drain, that it's all one unified being kind of channeling love and light. And some people will over time choose to radiate that love and light freely and selflessly, and other people will choose to try to absorb as much of it as they can out of this belief that, you know, really out of fear in this concept of separation.
That's a great point. I'm glad you added that in there too. That's really critical. It all kind of comes together, these complex, you know, concepts here, it seems, that you can look at them from multiple different angles. But yeah, you're exactly right. So I think we'll look at maybe now a brief quote as well I guess this one is 82.22. And this was talking a little bit about this pre-veiled condition. So I'll read this one here. There is the possibility of love of other selves and service to other selves, but there is an overwhelming awareness of the Creator in the self. The connection with the Creator is that of the umbilical cord. The security is total. Therefore, no love is terribly important, no pain terribly frightening. No effort, therefore, is made to serve for love or benefit from fear. So I think that one captures kind of the idea of what the, I guess we can maybe call it an issue, was prior to the veil. There is just, you were so content in your surroundings there. You knew you're the Creator. You knew everything's based on love, that there was no real drive or impetus to grow. And the other key quote that Rod talks about with this is the concept of the young child or entity who's been fed and clothed and taken care of, regardless of whether they do the schoolwork or not. They have no motivation necessarily to do their schoolwork because they know they're going to be taken care of regardless on the issue.
Exactly. There was no like real like horrible consequence to just being happy and, you know, enjoying life, which, you know, and as Ross says, prior to the veil, because of this lack of motivation, it took beings a really long time to graduate into fourth density. It eventually happened, but it was a really prolonged third density experience.
Yeah, that's a great point to add in there too, because that was really, I guess, that issue I was referring to there that I didn't highlight as well, is that, yeah, that was the spiritual growth was incredibly slow, it seemed like. So that's what they were trying to make. The Logos was trying to make an adjustment with by creating the veil.
And as you mentioned, we talked a little bit about this creating the service to self kind of polarity. It's interesting to think about, like, before the, you know, the veiling, when there wasn't this possibility of complete separation, beings couldn't even conceive of serving themselves at the expense of others, because everyone saw each other as being one. We were all kind of part of one thing. And it was only after this completion of the veil that the possibility for what we would call evil was first realized, which is sometimes called by Confederation sources the path of that which is not, which I think is really interesting. It's this idea that we, for the first time, can explore beyond the margins of unity, beyond the margins of oneness, and to explore a path where we think we're all separate and we can all, you know, look out just for ourselves at the expense of others. And it's almost like, you know, the character on a soap opera that develops in amnesia and has to completely relearn their true identity, but kind of becomes a better person as a result. You know, it's an interesting trope that has worked its way into popular culture, but I think it's really hinting at something bigger going on. You know, this idea that we've forgotten our true selves and that we have to kind of find our way back a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I think so too. And highlights some of the points we were talking about there of just this conscious development of morality, understanding right and wrong, your actions, how that the concept, I guess, of thought, word, and deed, and how that affects others, and how that is, I guess, guides you on your path through consciousness as well. And basically, one of the key concepts to the third density there is the relation to the heart. So whether you're going to open your heart in loving kindness or go inward and basically just take yourself as being the creator from that point and serving yourself only, as everyone else around you is basically subject to you. It's opening the heart, closing the heart, I guess, is one of the key points to this separation difference.
That's absolutely well said. It's kind of our last discussion about fear and love. It's really, we're either focusing on bringing down our walls or building them higher and thicker. You know what I mean? And that idea of conscience, of morality, it kind of tells us when we're out of balance. And if you're polarizing in service to others, it's like, oh, I should be more selfless and do more and be kinder. If you're polarizing in service to self, it's that, oh, I need to keep this for myself. I don't have enough to share. I need to, you know, take care of me and mine and not worry, let other people worry about them. You know what I mean? It's a different sense of conscience or morality.
It is. And it's like, you can use those too, the thoughts and feelings, as well as somewhat of an analytical view on how your thoughts work from that point. Do you feel bad when you hurt others, or do you feel better when you're out serving others or offering maybe food to the needy and stuff like that? That it's like, you can use it, you can analyze it, I guess, to kind of help you along your path and as a barometer maybe to the direction of where you're going.
I think that's a great point. You know, I always used to, when I was younger and I was seeking, I always used to think that, like, you know, we should think rationally and that our emotions are an illusion. But the more you kind of get into Confederation philosophy, like, the emotions run deeper than our rational brain, and they help guide us when we're in resonance with that vibration of unity or when we're not. So I think they're helpful. You know, our emotions and our biases can help guide us on the path in a way that the rational mind, you know, maybe can't.
I think you're right. And I think that also that whole concept there is why we can see that it's such intensified catalyst here in this third density experience, and also leading to a lot of this planetary dysfunction. But Ra does specify that, I guess, in this third density here, we have 100 times more catalyst than any other density outside of here. So it really puts in perspective how intense and that's probably why our thoughts, feelings, and emotions are so extreme and can be used then in different senses. But why this third density is so hard, because it's 100 times more intense.
Well, well said. I mean, it's the idea of, like, you know, we have suffering, an intensity of suffering here that is, like, can feel almost overwhelming. And so beings went from this protracted, long fourth density to an incredibly compact, intense, like, difficult experience. You know, as my wife and I kind of jokingly, we call it the meat grinder a little bit, because it can be so hard and almost overwhelming at times. But, you know, Ross says that we're never given more than we can handle. And some of the other sources quote, they mentioned that, like, if we're ever really feeling like we're at the end of our rope, we're just getting too much, we can't take it anymore, we can ask for it to be turned back a little bit. You know, you can make a heartfelt appeal to your higher self, to your guardians, your guides, to, like, hey, could you just turn it back a little bit? You know, I'm feeling like really ground down and overwhelmed. And they say that will be answered. So I think it's important. There's a lot of suffering going on out there. It's part of our growth. But if we're really feeling overwhelmed through prayer and meditation, we can ask that it be lightened a little bit.
I think that's a great message and very positive as well, because it seems, I know a lot of people can probably relate to that, sometimes this life can seem very intense at different stages, so that there is maybe something small that you can do about it that is potentially there to help, and that you do have these guides that are ready to help you as well. And I think the other key point too to this separation is that it opened the door to these mental conditions and different types of confusions that basically allowed us to then overly identify with our body and create this victim consciousness, or the desire to feel special or better than others, elite in other senses, and feeding of the ego, I guess, from that point too, that all of these different feelings of unworthiness stemmed from this initial idea of separation, or of being separate or feeling separate.
It's very true, you know, and we see that now, especially, like, the me generation, identity politics, we're all, like, doubling down on these trappings of our small self. I'm this, you're that. It's really this vibe of separation. you know, we see it on social media, we see it in personal branding, that's kind of worked its way, you know, in a capitalistic sense into how we're marketing ourselves. We're becoming a product, you know, in terms of these trappings of the small self as opposed to the universal self. And I think, you know, these feelings of being unworthy, of feeling like an outcast, they've also contributed to what we're seeing as really an epidemic of mass shootings, you know, bullying, people just, you know, channeling this feeling of separateness into kind of violent and negative thoughts and a desire to kind of get revenge, to be, you know, to get notoriety through the worst ways possible.
I think it's all basically a creation of the situation that we're in here and experiencing the separation and truly believing in this illusion in that sense that's creating those experiences. But just kind of, I like your meat grinder analogy, all kind of getting jammed in here now and seeing, having all these various experiences. And I think almost maybe on the opposite end too of what we're talking about, the polarizing standpoint, is the potential for the sinkhole of indifference that Rod talks about. So because of the separation here, certain entities can be caught up in this illusion. And I think Rod talks about seeking rest or seeking sleep, that you just kind of leave those entities be. So you're just trying to keep yourself comfortable, get through life, but not really do too much else. And yeah, I guess just really keep seeking comfort. So you're not committing to one path or the other. It's just kind of getting by at that point. And ultimately that leads to you just repeating this incarnation over and over and over, which there isn't anything necessarily wrong with that, but it's just, it's a more drawn out experience that you have the opportunity to try to pick one direction or the other because of this.
It's kind of a big problem, as Ra explains it, because we're, so much of our population is caught in this instant gratification, seeking pleasure, avoiding pain, this, but not really, you know, not really acting on the catalyst in the way it was intended, where we're doing the work spiritually to go one way or the other. We're kind of flopping back and forth as the situation presents itself, sometimes doing, you know, kind things, and other times doing selfish things instead of kind of really picking one and sticking with it.
Yeah, or not necessarily learning the lesson from some of that catalyst, because Ross says too, is if you don't learn the lessons from some of it, you'll experience it again over and over. So I wonder why some of these situations continually happen. There's something to be gleaned in there, not just learning to live with, say, whatever happened. There's something more behind it and a reason that you need to learn that lesson, and or the 2x4 to the head as they get to get your attention one direction or another. And I think that's maybe also the trauma idea as well, that that we experience quite a bit. And there's not much growth without trauma, it seems here.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, I think it's interesting because this concept of the trauma of separation that's inherent in us, it's kind of recognized by modern psychology, but through kind of a strictly biological lens, the idea that the trauma of birth, being separated from our mother, where the oneness of being with, you know, the umbilical cord, being one with our mothers in the womb, and the trauma of coming out into the harsh, you know, bright world and being separate from her, and then the idea of, you know, a later trauma from being weaned and, you know, no longer being breastfed. So it's kind of interesting that our modern psychology has this idea of the trauma of separation, but I think it actually goes a lot deeper. It's not just a physical bodily thing, but a very deep kind of spiritual wounding, for want of a better word, that we need to kind of heal over time.
Like almost an original wound in that sense there, that it's, yeah, the striving back for something to correct, to go back to that unity, I guess, from that point.
And as you mentioned at the beginning, it's really an illusion of separation. It's this mental feeling of separation, that we are always kind of part of the unity. There's nothing we could ever do to separate ourselves from that, but we have this deep sense of aloneness, of separateness. But it's truly an illusion that we work through over time. It's just to motivate us to kind of to polarize and do our lessons, for, as Ross said.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought it might be good. We've touched on a little bit, but how this concept of separation is used on the service to others and service to self path for those type of entities. So if we start by looking at the negative path or the service to self, we can see that this separation was used as a way to, I guess, justify enslaving or manipulating others. And some of the key reasons here is for the increase of personal wealth or power as seeing themselves greater than others. And some of the ways that's been done is through creating these type of class systems and showing themselves as better. And I think back all the way to the times that I think what Rod discusses when Yahweh came to our people at that point. I think that was during the Martian transition. And they decided to make the entities bigger and stronger as a way to develop. And I assume that was probably the brain as well, too, to develop faster. But what that did was created the serious inroad for the negative to tell them, okay, you're a bigger and stronger entity. You're better than others. And created that concept of the elite that really kind of took a side road, I guess, to the positive message and intention that Yahweh and the Confederation had.
Yeah, that's a great point. And like the whole game of like the service to self is to form an elite and then voluntarily enslave everybody that isn't elite. And then when they were asked to give examples of systems of slavery, you know, that are commonplace today, they were like, there's too many to even mention. And it's an interesting thing to think about, especially in like a capitalist society where we put so much value on wealth. And, you know, our politicians, our leaders are all wealthy, you know, our celebrities are all wealthy, all those beings, our sports stars, anyone that we are told to look up to or envy or try to emulate, it all has to do with the shallow materialistic sense of wealth or power.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes you kind of second guess of the different sort of things that we just willingly agree to or abide by that necessarily don't have to be that way, I guess, that it seems like they've made this, or the negative has made this sort of system, just you accept it, you live by this, these are the rules, when no, that's not the case. You don't have to constantly be put down or constantly felt like you were unworthy on there or agree to all these different control systems here. There is a pathway out, no matter as hard as it seems. It's they've made this commonplace, you know, and as unfortunate as it is.
Yeah, you're right. And we have a choice. We don't have to excel at the expense of others. You know, we can find our own path. I think a lot of young people are kind of waking up to that like they don't want to be part of this, you know, oppressive system. And I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of creative kind of alternate career paths that young people are coming up with because they don't want to have to play this kind of game of exploitation in the way that their parents or their grandparents might have.
Right. Stuck in a job, a 9-to-5 job every day for 50, 60 years, like to live out your life on there. Like it doesn't have to be that way. Serving somebody else as well too, or you don't see as much.
It's true. And as you mentioned, the separation is used to control us, to foment kind of hatred, fear of the other. That's, you know, often used as a justification for wars, which are really to allow the elite to control more resources on our planet. But we're usually given a pretext for war through kind of xenophobia, scapegoating, dehumanizing the other, the concept of the enemy being less than human. You see it in every war in history, the idea that they're not human. They're so different from us that they're not even human. And that, you know, we thought the same thing about the Native Americans, about the sub-Saharan Africans. These concepts of dehumanizing, devaluing human life through fear of the other or belief in separation have been used to control people and exploit people at a great price in human suffering over time.
And that's definitely been amplified now, it seems, through just social media, the news, all these different outlets where they can get these messages out to people. And it's up to you, I guess, your choice on what you believe and what you don't, but it's much more in your face and they can constantly maybe brainwash or any other, you know, present these messages to you constantly to make it feel like it's justified.
And anything, you know, as Jesus said, you know it by its fruit. Anything that's trying to peddle fear as a, you know, you can know you're trying to be manipulated. You know, it's this groupthink herd mentality. You know, as we've heard for the last couple of weeks, they're eating pets, they're eating cats, they're eating dogs. You know, not to mention any political candidates, but it's clearly fear-based fear-mongering to get people to rally against a perceived other, in my opinion.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's the seems like the complete MO of a lot of this. It's to drive that separation, to feed off that separation, and to, yeah, basically divide everybody as it is there and really amplify this illusion at that point.
And it's actually led to a whole industry, what we call the news industry, that's really designed to create fear, to create anxiety, to stimulate our lower energy centers and sow division as a way to manipulate us one way or the other. And we have some news channels that want to manipulate us one way, other news channels that want to manipulate us another way, but it's all sowing fear and division.
Yeah.
It's not unity based.
Right.
You know, another thing that we've seen historically is how some major religions that Ross says were Orion influenced have come to exploit this feeling of separation to fuel a belief in kind of unworthiness, you know, put a stumbling block in our spiritual path through notions of things like original sin, the idea that we were cast out of paradise because of our own unworthiness. Not even things that we did as individuals, but that we are inherently loathsome and unworthy as a species. And I think that was kind of part of the system that was designed to really commoditize Jesus's message of kind of love, forgiveness, and unity, and transform it into a system based on fear, of judgment, of unworthiness, of control, both of self and others, that was a way to bring great wealth and power to the church. As I'm fond of saying, before they can sell you the cure, they have to sell you the disease.
Yes.
And, you know, so Aaron Abke has a great kind of line of recent videos talking about how the message of Jesus was kind of co-opted by Paul and became really the Pauline gospel, or Pollyannity, as he has coined the term of. And for anybody that wants to explore that a little bit, Aaron Abke has done a very deep dive into the early Christian church, you know, the Essenes, the Nazarenes, and what their message was really about, and how it was diametrically opposed to the concepts that were, you know, the gospel of Paul, which is ultimately what the Roman Catholic Church came to embrace and what we know today as Christianity.
Yeah, because that gave them the control and the power inroad basically there, because it wasn't all negative, but it was an easy, I guess, low-bearing fruit for them to pick from and to basically instill at that point to create those messages and to get that power, control, money, and everything that that they were striving for, it seems.
That we're inherently unworthy and we need to go to them for redemption.
Mm-hmm. Instead of, yeah, you were born as another part of the Creator, all equally worthy, and have all this power within you, basically, with what's Jesus' message there, to love your neighbor as yourself and to love God wholeheartedly. So it doesn't get more simple than that. But
it isn't, and it's really the law of one. It's what we're talking about, serving others. And, you know, Aaron does a great job of explaining exactly that, you know, the message of Jesus was the law of one, demonstrating our understanding of unity through serving others selflessly. That's exactly what we're talking about. That was the original gospel and teaching of Jesus, is the teaching of Ra. They're the same thing.
Which is kind of fascinating, because it's like it's been there all along in different generations and different eras. The law of one is, you know, woven into everything. It's just a matter of then how it's used or potentially manipulated from there. But yeah, let's look a little bit at how the separation of the service to others entity then looks. I think we've started to talk about it, but I guess the part I would start with that I've found to be interesting is that this feeling of separation from what is loved, as in the Creator or this oneness, then creates this feeling or longing to reunite and return to the Creator for the positive entity. It's like, you know, there's more to this. You know, in your heart that something more is there. So it's like this impetus to then discover that or to start searching down that path. So it's, you don't always think of separation as a pathway for service to others to take, but it does help and it does amplify that seeking, I feel.
I think you're exactly right. We all have this deep longing to return to oneness, to overcome this feeling of isolation, of aloneness, of suffering that we want to transcend. And, you know, the Buddhists embrace this as well, that, you know, the path to overcome suffering is to overcome desire, you know. So this has woven itself into many world religions in different ways. The one thing that I want to mention is that the path of unity, the path of oneness, it's not about kind of fighting and opposing evil or service to self-polarity when we see it. It's really about developing our own self-awareness to identify and embrace and integrate our shadow, those aspects of service to self tendencies, fears, past traumas, weaknesses that we carry within us, so that we can kind of learn to love the self and open the heart. So I think it's really important in this time where we're constantly being pitted against one another. This is a time of great division, especially in an election cycle, that you don't overcome evil by judging it, by, you know, opposing it. You overcome it by loving it and forgiving it within reason. You know, as we've talked about,
yeah,
it requires some balance, because as Ross says, kind of love unrelieved by wisdom leads to exploitation, depletion, and eventual martyrdom. So we have to kind of set boundaries in our ability to love, so to avoid being placed under the boot of evil beings, as Ross says.
Yeah, it's easy for the service to others to become taken advantage of, it seems. So there is some sort of standing up for yourself and standing up for what's right, but while loving and accepting that path at the same way. So I won't say that's an easy concept to grasp, but it's something, I guess, to keep in mind as well, too, there, that it's a constant challenge, but it's important as well to not give up all of your freedoms and to give everything away in service at that point when you are depleting yourself, or as Ross says, they're martyrdom, basically ending your life for potentially not offering the greatest service that you could have in this incarnation.
And I feel like overcoming judgment, I mean, my tendency to judge is something that I'm working on, because it runs very deep, you know, and I think it's very easy to judge others for a variety of reasons. And the path of unity is learning to, you know, to bless them, not judge them, that we're all perfect divine beings manifesting in different forms, that we're all one, and, you know, embracing a vibration of unity rather than, you know, partiality or judgment.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's perfect there too.
I think another important point that Ra mentions is that this spiritual polarity, the service to self, service to others, they become unified again in early sixth density, where, you know, it's the density of unity, where all beings, in order to progress, have to embrace the true nature of other selves as the creator. So we all get back on the path of unity once we're in sixth density. And everyone's higher self, no matter what polarity you're at our level, is inherently service to others. So that idea of polarity at sixth density just becomes history. So I like to remind myself that the worst evil we see in third density is really just a phase that these beings will eventually grow out of.
A very, very hopeful message to take away too, since it can feel so real at different times here that you just don't see any way out of some of this. So that's, yeah, I appreciate that message. So the next point I think it was good to look at then was how this idea of the veil and separation then allow the service to others or service to self entities to develop will and faith, which is a very important concept that Ra talks about in the Law of One, with will being more of a force or a power of pure desire and something that we all possess, but it can be further cultivated and directed to help us polarize through our catalyst and to, as you mentioned, the disciplines of the personality, know yourself, accept yourself, become the creator. And I think at least maybe this puts it in the level of, or quantifies it, I guess, to Ra quotes. They say that you cannot ascribe this faculty too much importance. And in another verse, Ra says that the great conduit to the creator is this will here. So it just shows how important it is.
It's like the greatest power we have, what we choose to focus on and what we direct the light of our consciousness towards. You know, I think it's our greatest tool. You know, it determines the rate of our progress, how far we get in each incarnation, what we focus our attention on.
Yeah, definitely.
What we desire, really. It's another way to say intense desire or desire for seeking.
It is. And that's also what Ra talks about, too, that this will is one of the most significant functions that occurred from that veiling of the mind and just created the strength of this. And if will is like kind of up there as one of the top powers, I think faith is one of the others as well, too, that we're starting to talk about. And I guess I look at that as more of a faculty or an energy associated with the indigo ray that can be used to consciously transcend the illusion and open the doorway to infinite possibilities, as Rod talks about.
I think you're right. And, you know, one of the things that Kuo has mentioned is that faith isn't necessarily faith in anything specific. It's just a deeply internalized belief that we develop over time that whatever is happening to us at any given moment is providing us with the lessons and the opportunities for growth and learning that we need in this moment, that we're on kind of a firmly on our trajectory that will ultimately end well. So it doesn't have to be faith in whatever. It's just this idea that everything's going to be okay. Wherever we're at is bringing us the lessons that we need. And as you mentioned, this strong kind of cultivation of will and faith is really what we need to graduate into fourth density. So it's funny, you know, growing up as a pastor's son, I was always a little puzzled by Psalm 23, you know, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. And I was always like, thy rod and thy staff, what is a rod and a staff? What does that mean? I mean, how is a rod different from a staff? What is a rod? Is that like a club? Is that for punishment? Why would I find that comforting if I'm going to be punished? But I think it's interesting. It wasn't until I started understanding the raw material and then, you know, the archetypical mind, that first card, the magician, the matrix of the mind, in the Rider-Waite deck, he's holding a rod up above him. And it's the rod is this idea of an implement for focusing and directing the will. And in modern kind of myth, it's become the magic wand that we see, you know, in the magician's hand. And a staff is something that we lean against on our journey to help take a little weight off. So I think the idea of like the rod and the staff, it's really a metaphor for will and faith, which are the primary tools we have to help us get through, you know, the valley of the shadow of death, which is always symbolic of our journey of separation, our apparent death as a result of forgetting our true selves.
It makes a lot of sense as well, since so much of this is covered in symbology, metaphors, to try to really see that deep message through all of these sort of teachings here as well. So yeah, I think that's an excellent summary. And I think then one other development stage too that's worth talking about of this will and faith has to do with the strive for constant sense pleasures that we have in our society today, constantly looking for more material items or alcohol, food, sex, all these sort of different ways just to please our senses. But you're not really developing much through all of these when you're just striving for that. There's a greater purpose to all of this, and it's to seek the Creator and to develop that will to find the Creator from that sense.
You're right. We're like so many people get caught up in cycles of short-term, immediate pleasure, immediate gratification, which can lead to addiction. And eventually they realize that that's not a lasting path towards happiness, towards satisfaction. And that only comes through a longer journey and a longer process of growth.
Perfectly said, too. And I can't help but think of always the Amazon example, the, you know, same day, buy one click, you get your thing there. It's a constant satisfaction, but never really seems to be that lasting gratification that you're looking for.
Yeah, we're really in that give me convenience or give me death, as the dead Kennedy said. You know, my wife and I joke about that we've elevated this need for instant gratification to something that's, you know, basically absurd.
Yeah, beyond recognition at this point. And so I think then just a few key points to talk about on there for that developing will and faith. I find those to be cultivated through practices like meditation, spiritual seeking and practices, consciously opening the heart and in compassion, and then accepting and healing these shadow qualities that you were talking about earlier as well. And this basically allows you to know yourself, accept yourself, become the Creator, this great disciplines of the personality that Ra talks about quite a bit in there. And what you're doing along that path is cultivating that will and faith to be of service to others or to the self there. But you're strengthening those qualities to get to that point.
Well said. So I think, you know, as we try to wrap things up a little bit, Ra explains the importance of the veil through this metaphor of a great poker game. which we can only win by risking everything and kind of opening ourselves to love. So I'd like to read a quote for your listeners here. This is in 50.7 of the raw materials. So Don states, "Can you expand on the concept, which is this, that it is necessary for an entity to, during an incarnation in the physical, as we call it, become polarized or interact properly with other entities? And why this isn't possible in between incarnations when he's aware of what he wants to do? But why must he come into an incarnation and lose memory, conscious memory, of what he wants to do and then act in a way that he hopes to act? Could you expand on that, please?" And Ra says, "I am Ra. Let us give the example of the man who sees all the poker hands. He then knows the game. It is but child's play to gamble, for it is no risk. The other hands are known, the possibilities are known, and the hand will be played correctly, but with no interest. In time, space, and in the true color green density, the hands of all are open to the eye. The thoughts, the feelings, the troubles, all these may be seen. There is no deception and no desire for deception. Thus, much may be accomplished in harmony, but the mind, body, spirit gains little polarity from this interaction. Let us examine this metaphor and multiply it into the longest poker game you can imagine, a lifetime. The cards are love, dislike, limitation, unhappiness, pleasure, etc. They are dealt and redealt continuously. You may, during this incarnation, begin, and we stress begin, to know your own cards. You may begin to find the love within you. You may begin to balance your pleasure, your limitations, etc. However, your only indication of other selves' cards is to look into the eyes. You cannot remember your hand, their hands, perhaps even the rules of this game. This game can only be won by those who lose their cards in the melting influence of love, can only be won by those who lay their pleasures, their limitations, their all upon the table face up and say inwardly, all of you players, each other self, whatever your hand, I love you. This is the game to know, to accept, to forgive, to balance, and to open the self in love. This cannot be done without the forgetting, for it would carry no weight in the life of the mind, body, spirit, beingness, totality." And that last term, beingness, totality, is really Ra's way of describing the completed or perfected self upon the completion of our whole octave of experience.
Yeah. Yeah, and that quote's amazing there. It really kind of summarizes everything we've been talking about today, too, with the importance of the veil, the conditions that could have been before, and what we're ultimately striving to do, or ways to win this poker game of of life that we're experiencing now.
We have to risk it all and kind of, you know, lay it all on the table and open ourselves in love to win. I think that's a nice message.
Yeah, I think that's good. And kind of as a little bit of a summary there too, it seems this concept of being on top of the mountain, while it's beautiful, it doesn't give you that inner strength. It's that act of climbing that actually gets you there and creates that act of strength or will and faith. I think Ra even relates it to the hitchhiker on the road there, whether they're sitting in the car, discussing everything, not really seeing where they're going, or on the adventure on their own, taking every footstep, taking in all of this experience to really amplify the catalyst and that, the interpretation of it from there.
Well said. You know, it's the journey. It's that step-by-step journey of overcoming this feeling of separation created by the veil that really, you know, the mountain of separation that we all feel that we eventually have to overcome, that gives us this, you know, will and faith to fully graduate into fourth density and beyond. And as Ross says, that will and faith that we build by continuing to kind of find love where it can't readily be found, and in ways the Creator had not imagined before the veil, it lasts, you know, far beyond our third density, into the higher densities as well. But to develop this, we have to work kind of in darkness with a tiny candle of limited awareness to ultimately find our way out of third density.
Beautiful example there. And I think it's also a good reminder then to keep in mind that each of us has chosen to come here and to experience this darkness and separation. so that we can develop that will and faith and to really grow and to experience the Creator as it is, but also setting the tone for further densities as well through this experience here. Becoming a service to others entity really sets up your trajectory, I guess, from the higher densities as well. And we have great opportunity to use this catalyst here to aid, I guess, ourselves in higher densities and come up with another unique experience.
And, you know, ultimately, the Creator itself learns from each of our unique experiences in ways that it would not have had without them. So, you know, this separation from the veil is really not so much original sin as original sacrifice. It's something that we all willingly choose to make to help the great divine being become more than what it was through our own personal sacrifice and suffering that we all learn to overcome. And, you know, Ra mentions that kind of at the end of our journey through this whole octave of beingness, before we release all individuation and return once again to this undivided bliss of unity and oneness, that each of us lays the totality of our experiences kind of at the feet of the Creator as a, you know, an honestation and adornment by which each of us in our own unique way adds to that fullness and that beauty of this vast divine being of which we have always and ever been a part.
Oh, perfectly said. That's an excellent way to end this conversation here. So I'm real appreciate you coming out, Chris. This has been such a fun conversation. I hope the listeners enjoyed this as much as we did. So many great points to take from here and just other perspectives, I guess, to look at this veil and separation and the importance of it all as well.
Oh, the pleasure's been mine. I love our conversations. Thanks so much for having me on again.
Of course. I'm sure we'll do another one here. So I'd like to thank the listeners for joining in with us. Let us know if you have any questions or any other thoughts on this. We'd love to analyze it further. So thanks again. I leave you now in the love and in the light.